This is the interview of Mr. Robert E. Townsend on April 13th, 2011 in Madison, Wisconsin. Could you state your name and spell your last name, please?
I like my full name is Robert Ernest Townsend, and I'll spell the last name T-O-W-N-S-E-N-D.
Thank you. Thank you for being here with me today.
You're welcome, Ellie.
And allowing me this opportunity. First question. What was your childhood like, and how did being in a military family influence your view of the world, if it did?
Well, it's complicated, but my childhood was a farm boy childhood in northern Wisconsin. So my father left the military in 1945 after World War II, and we moved up to northern Wisconsin in 1947. And so it was a farm family childhood. But my last name is Townsend, Scots-Irish, born fighting. The American military, certainly the American Army, is composed of Scotch-Irish descendants. There are people who fight for the United States. So I come from a background where combat is in my background. So my father fought in World War II. My grandfather fought in World War I, my great-grandfather fought in the Civil War, and a whole passel of relatives fought in the War of Independence in the southern states. They come from the Scottish-English border region. Most of them immigrated to the United States in the early 1700s. So it was in the air. We fought the Korean War in recesses at our school, and major battles of World War II during the noon hour. We had big woods, large hills, open fields, rivers to wander and roam and do ambushes. So it was a daily basis for us. So family is in the past, military, and my children are military.
And what did your children do in the military?
I have two. My daughter is an Air Force colonel. She's on the general's list. Military is different than in my age, so they switch in and out of the reserve and the active duty. She's going back on active duty now in Alabama. My son's in the Air Force National Guard as an enlisted man. Yeah, that's it. The other kids are kids. My youngest daughter is a arms merchant. She works for a British defense firm in Dubai. My middle daughter, her husband worked for the Secret Service, now for the Treasury Department, and his job is a sniper. And we won't tell that story. We'll tell that story when we're offline.
That's incredible.
He's a pretty good boy. And a redneck, too. So.
Incredible family.
Now it's pretty common in Scots-Irish families to have that sort of story. In other traditions, not so. But it's spoken proudly in Scots-Irish families. In Jewish families, my wife's Jewish, it's not spoken proudly. I mean, if you have a son in the military, apparently not spoken of. If your son's a doctor, a lawyer, an academic, this is a matter of pride. But in the Jewish families, the military sons are black sheep. In the Scots-Irish families, the military sons are proud, and if you have a lawyer or a doctor or a academic. You're a little careful about admitting that. But percentage of population, Jews make up 3% of the U.S. population, and the general officer corps is 6% Jewish. But it's not admitted. So that's mysteries of America. So that's my background.
What was it like growing up in the Cold War era?
You know, you didn't Northern Wisconsin, you weren't really aware of it. The only thing you're aware of is in northern Wisconsin, you would see the contrails of Strategic Air Command bombers. The dew line was way up north, and I think what went through northern Wisconsin and the northern border area was called the Pine Tree Line. Pine Tree Line was a series of radar stations that were the third level of defense of a bomber attack from the Soviet Union via the North Pole, via the Antarctic. So those radar stations would be tested every so often for their capabilities, and oftentimes you'd see a B-52 bomber coming over the barn 500 feet, cows running in all directions, going through the electric fences, and you'd be thinking you'd shoot at them with the 30-30 next time they came over. Because, you know, they'd come over like bats, and no noise. You'd see them coming from the west, right at the tree line, or it looked like the tree line, and the noise wouldn't reach you until they're over the house. And they seemed to cover the whole horizon. Cows didn't like it. I didn't like it having to go out and repair electric fences. Other than that, so in our schools, we never did that duck and cover. We just didn't do it. And the only other thing was the Wisconsin agriculturalist, every so often, would print maps of where the F Milwaukee and Chicago were hit by nuclear weapons and wiped off the map. Where would the fallout land? And so they'd display the fallout paths as straight lines. And we'd check, and Lincoln County, Wisconsin wouldn't get the fallout. Now that was complete and utter BS, because the winds would swirl, and they weren't. The winds were not northwest winds. The winds were swirling winds. So it'd be everywhere. But we checked. In Antigo, 20 miles to the east, they got it. But Antigo deserved it.
So you never saw any of the educational videos in class or anything like that about the duck and cover things?
Never saw it. Never did. I don't know why. Guess it was a state issue. And the state didn't have many nuclear targets, I suppose. And we've never... Life magazine would talk about people digging fallout shelters. We never did.
Why did you choose to attend the University of Wisconsin-Madison?
Of course, to get out of northern Wisconsin. All of us, family came from Chicago, our stories were from Chicago, our stories were from elsewhere. My family were, on my mother's side, were immigrants from Yugoslavia. My father ran away from home when he was 14. We were all the stories of our family were stories of wandering and traveling. There is no desire to stay in Gleason, Wisconsin. So going to Stevens Point was like going to high school. Wasn't it enough? And so University of Chicago, Wisconsin, I wanted to play football. And the tuition was $116 a semester. So I didn't get a scholarship, but I was going to try and make it as a walk-on. I weighed 195 pounds when I went to the University of Wisconsin. At the end of the first freshman season, I weighed 165 pounds. Not enough. And as simply too light, even at that time, to play. So, we had to do some, they insisted we take courses while we're playing football. Can you imagine that? So for a sort of barracks braggadocio reason, I signed up for Russian. Now my mother's family is from Yugoslavia, but Russian was a Cold War issue at the time. And we had to sign up in these long lines at the Red Gym. And there was a very pretty girl who was in a line. I stood in the line behind her. And she signed up for Russian, and so did I. And then dated for the next 4 years.
And how did that turn out?
It was painful, a painful tragedy. She was left-wing, Princetonian liberal. I was a redneck conservative trying to hide it. And so we parted at Travis Air Force Base on my way to Vietnam. And there was just no, she wanted me to go to Canada. It was just unacceptable to me. So she stuck by her guns and I stuck by my guns, as it were. And then we stopped writing in Vietnam.
What were some of your favorite memories from UW?
The favorite, there's three major ones. One, the memories of the secret of education at the university level is your fellow students. That's where you get your education. So my roommate, Michael Friedenthal, was from the East Coast. His circle of friends, Jewish or Gentile, were politically active and artistically active. And I'm a redneck from northern Wisconsin. I had my positions. And I'm quick on my feet. So the memories of political and artistic arguments with liberal conservative arguments. So there's at that level, there wasn't the hard political positions that I see nowadays. You're willing to flow. The university was a emotional cataclysm for all of us. Whoever put the university together in those days mixed contrary Americans. Not only was the army the great melting pot of the United States, but the university, the Big Ten universities certainly were. Strange people were put next to one another. So those political, artistic, emotional arguments were strong memories. The other memory was Dr. Michael Petrovich, who has a library room named after him now. He taught European history. Spectacular teacher. Also Dr. Victor Terras of the Slavic Languages Department, who taught two courses, one on Dostoevsky, the other on Tolstoy. Eye-opening. And then there's a third memory. Well, the demonstrations, which my arguments with my roommates and my circle of friends challenged your core beliefs. The demonstrations in 68 and 69 and the riots split us. It made you, the demonstrations wanted you to commit one way or the other. And we went three ways, our circle of friends. I became more pro-American, but but not radically pro-American. Many dropped out from the political argument. Drugs were becoming serious, were widespread at the time. Dropping out was widespread, going to farms and going to communes and stuff like that. And then another smaller percentage went radical, became communist, Trotskyite, Maoist, socialist, and became activists. By the time I left in 69, people were going in their ways. 70 and 71, when serious riots occurred, or bombings and stuff like that, that was the result of those arguments leading their way. Now, I was doing bombing in Vietnam, and there were some of my colleagues involved in that horseshit here. So, and then what was the third one? Third memory.
That was three.
Was that three? Mm-hmm. Okay, there was. But it was an exciting, exciting time. And it made you, and the exciting part of it was, it questioned your, challenged your values to the core. Challenged. Boy, it was tough. It was great.
Were you at UW during the main student riot outside the Commerce Building?
I was. And talk about chance. I was linked, arm to arm, in the Commerce Building with my friends. I had to go to my ROTC class. I said, I'll be back in an hour. I have to go to ROTC. I came back, and the police had come in, heads bloody, guys with split skulls, not split skulls, they were not split skulls, but they were showing me tear gas all over the place. And I thought, Jesus Christ, am I glad I wasn't there. But, you know, when you're a soldier, you come to a lot of those occasions, you know, when the bullet goes through your plexiglass cockpit, 6 inches in front of your head. So chance rules all our lives. Both chance and your own decisions. Who knows? So yes, I saw those riots. My apartment was at 534 State Street. It's where Steepenbrew is now. There were some old people in there. I was the only student there. $32 a month for the rent, and $32 a month at an eating co-op. $64 a month, room and board. But there's a nice porch, and I would sit with the old people while the students had come up the street. And then the cops would rush at them. And there was clanging. And then it was becoming, you know, the National Guard, the police and the National Guard were not trained in crowd control. And then just got everybody irritated. So it began basically as a panty raid. And then people were being committed either way. There were many people at the beginning of demonstrations who just floated off and went their other ways, and others became more committed. The police were a couple of shots across the street from us. We watched. A kid threw a Molotov cocktail from the roof. Policeman crouched and shot at him, missed him. Kid had recoiled back. But so violence was right there. So there was shooting, and then the students were breaking, the rioters were breaking windows, the pub lost its front windows. A couple of other hippie stores, you know, kids threw bricks around. And then it sort of dissipated. Everybody got tired of it or something. Then the National Guard came on. And the National Guard was a more calming influence. Many of the kids were in the National Guard. So came back. And in the University of Wisconsin, it seemed to calm it down that year, 68. It was 68. 69, I graduated, and I don't remember any riots then.
Speaking of the National Guard, how did the massacre at Penn State, when they called in the National Guard and they fired on students, how did that make you feel?
In Kent State, yeah.
Penn State?
Kent State.
Kent State?
Yeah. There's a scene in From Here to Eternity by James Jones. National Guard being ill-trained to handle riots is a tradition in the United States. So the National Guard had often been called out to break strikes. My father was in the National Guard. My mother would tease him about being a strike breaker.
That was their original duty when they were first created. Arguably.
Arguably. And, you know, they're always armed. So there's a scene in From Here to Eternity where one of the characters is on the line against strike breakers. And he pulls the trigger first. And then as he pulls the trigger, everybody else starts shooting. And that's what happens. For some reason, they had the guys had bullets chambered rather than not chambered. The M16 has a touchy trigger. So it was a terrible accident, but it was also, again, ill-trained National Guardsmen, badly deployed. This group of 16 or 30 National Guardsmen were left by themselves. You got to use masks. And so it was a terrible accident, and I saw it as that. It was, it's more complicated. And some of the other questions address the core conflicts here, but particularly badly trained soldiers are a danger wherever they're at. Badly trained soldiers, bad stuff. And the National Guard in the 60s was where you went in order not to go to Vietnam. And they simply were badly trained. They're just, the National Guard was just to kill time on the weekend. National Guard armories in every town in Wisconsin. At that time, the conventional army considered it would take a year to bring a National Guard division up to combat readiness. There's a great deal of conflict at that time between National Guard officers and regular Army officers, but there's a disdain in the regular Army for the National Guard. The disdain was the other way too. The disdain went back through 20th century Army history. My father would point out that they were better soldiers than the regular Army. And they were better soldiers than the Marines. And, you know, it was a soldier braggadocio. So it made no serious impact on me. The kids shouldn't have been rioting. The guard should have been better trained. And there's a part of another story that was more important to me there rather than just that incident. And we may wait to the question, but I was clear at that time that communism was a very bad thing. It was a genocidal form of government. Their method of population control was terror. By now, we know it was a one-to-one correlation. When a communist government took control of a country, genocide resulted. 1-to-1. The genocide may have been more or less severe. It was horrendous in Red China. It was horrendous in Soviet Russia. We don't have the records yet in Albania. Genocide occurred when these old Stalinists or Leninists took control. We knew about the genocides in North Vietnam at that time. 1965 through 69, there is enough source material available to know that when a communist government came to power, genocide was the result. It's clear now, but it was clear enough in 65. And as a farmer, as a farm boy, the first people collectivized, collectivization being another name for genocide. It was hard, it would have been hard on my people. So there is no question. On one side were mass murderers, on the other side were people who were oftentimes, were people, U.S. Army and associate, were oftentimes ill-trained and ill-prepared to fight, and were clumsy at fighting. They had their rounds chambered instead of unchambered, stupid. But even at that time, you knew the difference, if you chose to believe it, besides that, between that which was mostly evil and that which was mostly good. Communism was mostly evil. You knew it in 1965. The evidence is incontrovertible now, but it was clear. So, you're either for genocide or against it.
What were the major events that occurred in Madison and in the world while you were on campus? We've covered this a little bit, but...
Expand
a little bit?
So there are the Dow riots on campus and spring riots. And so they sort of thought they replaced panty raids because they always occurred in the springtime when you're tired of school. And they certainly didn't occur in December and January. Vietnam War was the main issue. 1965, when I went to enrolled at the University of Wisconsin, was the first major battle, Battle of Ydrang Valley. First major confrontation between U.S. and North Vietnamese troops. And it just slowly built up from there. That's all I remember. What else happened? I know, it was Vietnam. And so the music, Beatles, the transition from Patsy Cline and country western, the early rockers and Elvis Presley, to then the Beatles struck at my senior year in high school, Wanna Hold Your Hands, and then through that whole period. So it was music and the major conflict between communism and capitalism, for lack of a better word. That's all I can remember.
So Vietnam and the Cold War very much defined your college experience at UW?
Indeed it did. So the nuclear arms control negotiations and stuff, I wasn't aware of those until I became an arms control negotiator myself. And Otis Redding died in Madison. I had tickets to his concert on December 19th, 1966, I think. I walked down Gorham Street, freezing night, with my girlfriend, Julia, and walked in there, everybody with tears in their eyes. And they assured us we'd get our money back. And it was $8 a piece. I mean, that was, $8 was 1/4 of what I spent for rent. So that was pretty serious. And I remember being, pleased that I wouldn't have to spend all that money. Subsequent to that, then I figured out who Otis Redding was, and I would have spent the money. It was a great loss. Nothing else.
How did these events help shape or change the way that you viewed the world?
It was crucial to the way I viewed the world. I came into the university with a worldview. The worldview was sharply challenged by my colleagues, by my friends, by my circle of friends. Sharply challenged. I became less of a, feminists call that? For men who are crude to
womanizer?
Women. No, it's a pig, I guess.
You pig.
So I was a male supremacist when I went to the university, and that was taken out of my system. And I flirted with liberalism, but in my arguments with my colleagues, it didn't work for me. It didn't work because of the communism-capitalism argument, because those arguments among us careless students were conflated. We often were unable to separate them out. Political argument between a system of government and a system of personal relationships was hard to sort out. It was hard for the next 40, 50 years. Shit, I remember coming back to the United States in the 80s, 90s. When was Clinton president? I'll remember that in a second. But, feminist position was the personal is political. You know, if you're mean to women, you're a mean human being. If you abuse women, you're an abuser. So, Clinton got caught. Yeah, he was a serial abuser of women. And so suddenly, the personal no longer was political. But I accepted that the personal is political. If you're abusive to females, you're a bad person. And I starkly changed my attitude. It's hard. It's hard to come from that position, from male above female to male equal to female to, it's not male-female, it's one human to another interaction. It's not a male-female dichotomy. Yes, there's differences. I'm much stronger than my wife. And no way is she going to develop biceps, and she's not going to define her muscles. It's just not going to work. Weight, no matter what weightlifting she does. So there's differences, but to approach each other male-female is fundamentally incorrect. You approach each other as human beings. But that's also what you can do when you're 60 years old, and you may not be able to do that when you're 20 years old. But the argument then was, I look, again, I'm repeating, males were superior to females. Over my college years, males were equal to females. It took me many years to work on that issue. My daughters really worked on that. And then it's not a male-female issue. It's a human-to-human issue. There are females who are génocidaires, and there's no word for it in English for those who commit genocide. But there's a good word in French called génocidaire in Rwanda. It gained strength.
Essentially, it's perpetrators of genocide?
Perpetrators of genocide. French nails it. I don't know why. So they can be both female and male, and they were, and they are. And those who fight against that, male or female. What was the question?
It was how do these events help shape your view of the world?
And then it made me commit one way or the other. I was either anti-American or pro-American. There was no choice. You're pro-American, and then you went that way. And within that pro-American way, you had to make your choices. You weren't a George Wallace pro-American. You weren't a Mark McCarthy pro-American. But as opposed to those communist governments, there you had to make your decision. Now it's still complicated, very complicated. You never knew until it was over whether you made the right decision or not. But I batted 307. 307 gets you into the Hall of Fame, you know. So, next.
We could discuss these. Do you remember any significant reaction on campus and or in the media to the Tet Offensive in Vietnam in January 31st, 1968?
I don't remember. Everything I know about the Tet Offensive came subsequent to that. And in fact, came subsequent to my military career. I knew that when I examined it. At the time, it appeared that we had lost. It was some sort of victory for the North Vietnamese. Then as I examined a few of the after-action reports several years later, it was clear that it was an utter disaster for the Vietnamese, for the Viet Cong. And in fact, when I went to Vietnam, it's a complicated story, I got there in mid-70s. And it had left in the end of 71. Vietnam was pacified. I hitchhiked from Tonsonet to Benoit, 30 miles. Roads were full of trucks and cars and civilian population. It was at peace. It was stupid to hitchhike, but I did. No notice. All of the battles that I was engaging in from the Air Force were in the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos and then in Cambodia. And after I'd been there for several months, I became an advisor, because I spoke French, to the Cambodian Air Force. It's its own story. But the major battles were well outside of Vietnam. And it was with the North Vietnamese main force divisions, which were devastating when we found them. Story in its own right. And by the time I left, I was bored to oblivion. It was clear we had won the war. The Viet Cong was devastated by the Tet Offensive. The North Vietnamese main formations were finding them and destroying them one after another. And it seemed like when I had left that we had so emptied the North Vietnamese young man population cohort 17 to 21 that they had no more formations to send south. They did, but they're severely depleted in manpower. So I was looking for an exciting place to go, and I got an assignment to Berlin, Germany in late 71. To me, we had won the war. And in fact, it's a whole different story, much of which I don't have sorted out yet, and I will by the time I finish these three novels. I've taken care of them. It's hard that when you're in the midst of a drama like this, it's hard to know when you're winning or losing. It's hard to know what the status is. Last note, hard to know what the status is. 1989, from 1982 to 1989, I ran the counter-deception directorate for the Air Staff, and it was located at a CIA facility. It was 7 years of exhausting intellectual work. By the time I retired from the military, I was as exhausted as I'd ever been in my life. And the Soviet Union was as strong as it had been in 1982. We're putting together a great U.S. military, but it was tough. I was too tired. I left the military because I just had no more to give. Okay, I left the military in July 1989. October 1989, the Berlin Wall was torn down. And a year and a half after that, the communist flag went down over the Kremlin, and that blue and white flag went up. Go figure. So here's you're interviewing one of America's ace intelligence officers. Wrong continually through to the end.
I don't think you're an exception.
Clearly not. Soon thereafter, Saddam? Yeah, oh Christ. U.S. intelligence has its problems. Different story.
Going back to your time on campus,
hey.
Do you remember any significant reaction on campus and or in the media to the New York Times article on March 10th, 1968 that leaked information that Westmoreland was requesting 206,000 more soldiers for the Vietnam War?
I remember no reaction whatsoever. Nope. Blew right by me. 1968 that was. Nope. I must add a couple of papers to do, and I was always behind in Russian. Never seemed like I'd ever be able to speak that damn language. So that's what I was concentrating on. And maybe Julie and I were having some terrible emotional problems at that time. So the world passed me by. I was already in ROTC. I was going to go into the military anyway. The draft, the number of personnel that needed in Vietnam, was a matter of some indifference to me.
Although you had already graduated in 1969, what effect did the Sterling Hall bombing on August 24th, 1970 have on you, if any?
None. I was in Vietnam by the time. It was just more commotion. In fact, it didn't seem, there were lots of other bombings around the United States at the time, and it had no, it didn't. About the only thing I remember about it is, where the hell was Sterling Hall? Oh yeah, where that? Was that just outside Bascom? Oh, yeah, it was. Oh, I walked across there many times and then went back and did whatever I was doing.
Would you like to take a break? Or are you fine?
I'm fine.
All right. So you were in the ROTC during your time at Madison, and that's what influenced you to go into the military then, or into the Air Force?
Yeah. The other thing that influenced me to go into the Air Force is, my father, who was a career Army man, and career Army infantryman. And all during World War II, he'd look up at the sky, see those planes going back to base while he's sitting in a tank or a foxhole, and no child of mine is going to be in this goddamn Army. And so he guided me towards the Air Force. And my older brother then was in the Air Force. And just went that way. And it was $50 a month. And so my room and board was $64 a month. Met most of my requirements.
Did you feel that you had an obligation to join the military because of your family's background?
Family background, my consciousness of what we're fighting for. And I was able to win the arguments through college. And those arguments that I was not able to win, I simply ignored. So yeah, family background, and again, it was clear in the 60s what the impact of communism was wherever it took power. And you could get access to the archives. The details are much, there's much more detail now, but you know. Particularly if you're studying Russian. You read the reports. The people were honest. You knew about the collectivization of agriculture. You knew about the collectivization of agriculture in Red China. You knew about the collectivization of agriculture in North Vietnam. You knew about the collectivization of agriculture in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Germany, whatever. You knew that wherever the communists arrived, the natives took off. It never happened the other way. So, and the farmers were the first to leave. He just knew it. So the evidence was incontrovertible, and you had to really BS yourself to see it another way. So, both family tradition and what you could see around you. And then, Air Force. My dad didn't want me to go in the Army. And I knew what the pay of an enlisted man was. Enlisted pay, at that time, was less than $100 a month for one striker. And in 1965 it was. And my pay as a second lieutenant was $600 a month. That too. And when I got into the military in 69, all of a sudden a bunch of raises started coming through. I couldn't believe how much money I had. I think I was making $1,200 a month by the time I got to Berlin.
Wow. So what did you do with all that money?
Spent it. Usually had enough to make it to the end of the month. And Berlin was bachelor's paradise, let me tell you, in 1971 through 75. It's very nice. Just very nice.
What was your normal day-to-day routine while in Vietnam?
I was stationed in Korat, Thailand. The unit, when I went into the pipeline, the unit was in Vietnam, in Da Nang, and then while I was processing, the unit moved over to Thailand, Korat, Thailand. So my routine was we'd fly every 3 days. Our flights were 12 to 14 hours long. And so it was exhausting flights. So one day you'd do the mission, next day you'd sleep and rest. Third days you'd go back in and go into the office and prepare for the next mission. And then the day after that you'd go do the mission. And it became a cycle like that. You'd get 4 days off a month, which would either go to Pattaya on the beach, or Bangkok, which costs a lot of money, or sometimes Chiang Mai. I did that for 18 months. You'd get a 30-day leave if you once you did this R&R. It's 30 days off. It'd send you anywhere. And then if you re-upped for another tour, you'd get a 30-day R&R. So once I went to Europe, and it wasn't 30 days. You'd get an R&R, which was 7 days, fly you anywhere. And then if you re-upped, you'd get a 30-day. So my 30 days, I went to Europe, because I knew I'd never get stationed there. And my two R&Rs, I went either to Australia, and then Japan. So it was a pretty regular cycle. And sometimes you'd have downtime. So the missions would slow down. And then, so those were the 14-hour missions, complicated in their own right. And then oftentimes I would catch flights in OB-10s just for the fun of it, and you'd go over and serve as a translator for the Cambodian ground commanders, translating for the front-end pilot. And so I know a lot of French military jargon and French numbers, because you always had to know the UTM grids and be able to 10 buffalo, 3 running bicyclists, that sort of thing. Les bicyclettes de Phnom Penh. So that was my day in Vietnam, or in Thailand.
What were the kind of missions that you ran?
There were 3 different kinds. We ran what was called the Eagle Light program, which were sensors up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail network and try and follow the truck traffic, infantry traffic, truck and infantry traffic. Yeah, I don't know, it worked. I'm hearing a friend of mine in one of my classes is writing what a waste of money the Eagle White program was. Oh, I have to look at it. I thought it looked pretty good.
So it was kind of a survey mission or surveying?
You were at 16,000 feet and these sensors were set in the ground. And whenever they were disturbed by ground vibrations or whatever, they would send a signal up to the aircraft. And if you saw a pattern, one sensor, then the next sensor, then with various mathematical calculations, you could figure out how much of what was going through there. And then at the same time, the C-130s were working the trail, so we'd call those movements into the C-130s, and some nights it was pretty effective because they had 105mm cannons in the back, and when they'd hit a truck with that, that truck would stay hit. And so if you could trap the truck traffic in narrow places in the trail, you could really chew up the trucks. The idea, you're always doing this when you're any military force moving troops and transport through a defended area or moderately defended area. You just accept certain percentage of loss. So if you lost 40%, then you just increase your push more. So the Vietnamese were always able to get down what they needed to get down. Another mission was when we'd fly over Cambodia, we would fly with a Cambodian officer, a Vietnamese officer, and a Thai officer, and then an American colonel, and then I would do the translating for those who spoke French. And we'd run the air war over Cambodia, so it was airborne command and control. And then the third type of mission was these OV-10s. I'd generally try and get on for the fun of it. So maybe 20 OV-10 missions.
And what kind of missions are those?
Those were forward air controllers, small aircraft, two engines on either side. They're miserable little aircraft, but such a buzzing. And the rear guy in the rear was always flying right next to the engines. Kind of just, you'd have a headache for 3 days after the flight. It was only at most six hour mission. Nothing compared to the other ones. So that was my day.
What was your opinion of the Viet Cong and the NVA then, and how is it? Has your view changed with hindsight, if at all?
You know, we're at 18,000 feet. So we're in the Air Force. So we had no direct interaction with them. I see the whole world as a bell curve. And there are many brave soldiers among the North Vietnamese. There are many murdering sons of bitches. They fought bravely for an awful cause. And those years we were there, it was bad business being a North Vietnamese soldier, because your lifespan was not long. And 70 and 71, it was a horrendous experience. The North Vietnamese would like to show these, the Chu Lai underground bunkers. Tourists take tours there now. But we found many of those bunker complexes, and being buried underground by a B-52 strike. Horrible. Could only be a horrible experience. And they could only wait till it hit them. So they died by the hundreds of thousands. Fought well. But fought... This is nothing particular. I'm very familiar with how the Soviet Union and Soviet soldiers fought. And the North Vietnamese fought no differently. In the Soviet Army, both Civil War, World War II, is the Soviet line soldiers would be put to the front, and NKVD divisions would be put behind them as Prime Minister Brezhnev's responsibility. As one of his responsibilities is when the frontline troops broke, they'd machine gun them. That was the Communist Army technique of the equivalent of MPs. The American Army has MPs in order to keep troops from breaking. They turn them around and try and reorganize them back. But in the Soviet Army, and the Red Chinese armies, and the North Vietnamese armies, they were capital punishment was a way of keeping troops in the field. I remember a couple of times catching tank attacks directed towards Da Nang and the Soviet. North and East tank attacks. We'd followed him down the trail. We'd catch him, report him going down. So we were waiting for him when they'd come out. And they were just massacred. But the drivers were chained to the tanks, chained to inside the tanks. And it was likewise, that's how the Soviet Army often operated and the Red Chinese Army operated. Suicide. So, some, you know, Red Army war stories, I read them, they're truthful. But they're also screened. You're only allowed to write the correct war stories, some of which were true. But it was mostly evil. Sometimes you gotta accept that. Took a long time for me to figure that out. But I tended towards that direction.
What did you think about most while you were in Vietnam?
Women and booze. It was not, my war was not a hard war. I flew. We always stayed well above the rated AAA in the area. If there's a report of AAA that would reach our altitude, we went after it, found it, and destroyed it. So it was a good war for me. And it became boring. So I was looking for other things to do. By the time I was there, we knew the war was pulling down, drying down. So we were looking for other things to keep our life occupied. So Thailand was a wonderful place to be. I was making lots of money. So keeping the mission going. And going to find Western women in Bangkok and Pattaya and trying to make my money last to the end of the month. Check if I could do that. And where I was going to go next. Because our part of the war at that time was pretty limited. We were watching sensors. We're translating, and then I would look for opportunities to go in forward air controllers because I wanted more fun than up at 16,000 feet.
Why did you think the United States was fighting in Vietnam?
To prevent genocide. People knew what would happen with communist takeovers. So that was the first excuse. So, you know, we still, you know, I was saying, you're there for the oil off Vietnam. Still haven't gotten the oil off of Vietnam. And, you know, it was the Cold War between one system and another. And that, this is intricate. But, and these are time delays in understanding. The Soviet Union, in retrospect, this is what happened in all of these Soviet states. Those first leaders, the Lenin, the Stalin, the Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, they were dedicated Marxist-Leninists. And they're going to remake their societies. probably should have understood that, but I wasn't smart enough. When the next generation, which had to live with those genocidaires, those perpetrators of genocide, came to power, like children of drunken and abusive parents, after a time, they didn't want to do that anymore. So those states became milder. So, when Khrushchev took over for Stalin, he opened the prison camps, tried to make Marxism with a human face. Mao Zedong died, became state Marxism, something like that, over a period of time. When Ho Chi Minh died, American prisoners of war there reported that one day, all of a sudden, the North Vietnamese guards no longer were torturing them. A professionalism within the course of a day. That was going on. That was going on. And they said a couple weeks later, they found out that was the day Ho Chi Minh died. So the world changed when a generation of communist leaders died off. That's what we're hoping for. It worked. But I didn't and many of us didn't realize that until after the Soviet Union collapsed. We're soldiers. We're in Europe from 78 through 89. We're preparing to destroy the Soviet army. We're deploying the weapon systems and command and control systems that could accomplish that. We can blame that on Steven Jobs and Andrew Wozniak. Why? Bill Gates also. Because they drove down the price of the microchip. So we're able to develop a command and control system and weapon systems that negated all of that money the Soviets put into tank and military formations. They are now vulnerable to mass non-nuclear destruction. The Soviet Union just decided not to try and go to the next round. Another story there, but you know, Gorbachev and company got access to the archives. And Gorbachev said, how can a ideology that perpetrated this be allowed to survive? Gorbachev. He didn't. So, but in retrospect, we saw that. When you're in the midst of it, you didn't. Now that I'm studying Khrushchev closely now, and you could see him figuring out over time that life was different than it was under Stalin. For him, Brezhnev turned it around, then got old. So it wasn't easy to sort out. Yeah, as a soldier, you're always going worst case scenario. It's Jeff.
Did you agree with the reasons that the United States was fighting in Vietnam at the time?
Yes, completely. Now, when you fight, you got to win. And the United States Army used a bad strategy. Their strategy, mass formations, a battle to be fought on the central plains of Europe, was not applicable in Vietnam. And that a strategy just destroyed the landscape. When Westmoreland was replaced by Creighton Adams, the strategy changed.
Abrams,
that's right. Creighton Abrams. Abrams tank. Mm-hmm. The strategy changed, but by then it was too late. Abrams instead of search and destroy, was changed strategy to protecting the natives, and with main force army divisions ready to confront main force Viet Cong, North Vietnamese divisions. So that strategy was worked. But by that time, the army was so committed to its search and destroy mission that it couldn't change. Now, to forgive the army, at the same time, they had to maintain those that strategy for battle in Europe. So, army too difficult to manage, two different strategies, and it was you have to think that General Petraeus is a military genius for United States Army went into Iraq using that strategy designed for the plains of Europe. Worked just fine to defeat Saddam Hussein. Didn't work worth shit to pacify the country. And the army took our army several years to change their strategy. And then change strategy won the battle. But it's hard. That's hard stuff. Doing that strategy. I worked on air land battle for years and years. It was difficult getting that accepted by all the Air Force, Army, and whatever, and the NATO forces. Hard. Changing strategies is difficult. Fighting two strategies at one time didn't work in Vietnam.
How did you feel when you found out the U.S. was ending military involvement in Vietnam?
I was doing something else at the time. I was in Berlin and trying to figure out what the Soviet Army was about. I think the Arab-Israeli War, Yom Kippur War, October 1973, had a life-changing impression upon me. Till that time, really what I was in the military for was to have a good time and find women. And I would work when I had to. But it was clear that Israel nearly disappeared in October 8th, 1973. You would have had another chapter on genocide had the Syrian army broken through on the Golan Heights, got into the plain of Sharon. There was no Israeli army forces between the sea, well, between the Jordan River and the Syrians. It was the third, what's it when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, the third temple. It's the return of the Third Temple on October 8th, 1973. Okay, and then this happened, that happened, then the U.S. went on nuclear alert late in the month, and all that sorted itself out, and then peace returned. And then we looked at that. And it slowly dawned on me that military life is a serious fucking business. And the Soviet army, the war plan that nearly defeated the Israelis was the Soviet war plan. Soviet strategy and tactics. For some reason, the Syrian army paused on the battlefield. It met its objectives and paused rather than breaking through to the Jordan. And in that pause, the Israelis were able to change tactics and suppress the Syrian tank formations. The Soviet army has never been, it's the Russian army, has never been pleasant in the offensive. And there they were, all over the place, ready. Five armies in Germany, two in Czechoslovakia, and armies as back as far as I could see to the Kiev military district. They're planning to win. And had they won, you know, the formations were there. All you had to say was go, and go they went. They would have gone. And it would have been Armageddon. So there's two ways to deal with that. Ignore it or confront it. And what we learned from the Israeli counterattack became the basis of airline battle and Army Field Manual 100-5, which was airline battle. And that stopped. That gave the Soviets pause, because we're deploying the forces that could defeat their war plan. Whether we had them out there at 89 or not, Gorbachev, it was good enough excuse for Gorbachev not to press forward. But it was because of the near destruction of Israel in 1973 that two things. Among my group of peers who left Vietnam with a sense of defeat, and the lessons learned in the Yom Kippur War of 73, okay, we're going to win the next one. And so we became the mid-level officers, majors to one-star generals, who put together the war plans, purchased the equipment to win that next war, which was not used on the Central Plain, but in the first and second Gulf Wars. It was a cakewalk. And my daughter, Marcy, now the colonel, was on the first plane load into Saudi Arabia. She preceded the 82nd Airborne to the Kuwait-Saudi Arabian border because she was in a pathfinder, you know, and they put down beacons and stuff so the 82nd Airborne could fly in. A little blonde, cuter, the little fatigues and the blonde hair and stuff. Tough. The one who nearly died from the Tegretol overdose. Proud of those kids.
Did you do anything in your time between Vietnam and your time in military intelligence in Europe?
No. Went straight to passed through the United States, went straight to Berlin and was there for Christmas 1971, and stayed there for 4 years. Came back to the National Security Agency. It was awful, but I got my master's degree. But did get married in 78 and get the hell out of Washington, D.C. For a couple of reasons. And my wife had three children at the time. We went back to Germany. One, because I realized that her mother was crazier than a loon, and I had to get her away from her her family. And the best, most honorable way to do it was on being transferred. So I got an assignment, and it was wonderful. We're in Ramstein, Germany. I was doing the war planning, the new intelligence systems, and it was just lived in a small German village. I speak German also, so it was great. The three kids, Robbie, Marcy, and Debbie, and two more were born over there. They didn't understand how I knew everything they were doing. They couldn't get away with a thing. And, they didn't connect that I could speak German, and that the Germans were like, you know, anybody, all our neighbors here. They'd tell me when the kids were screwing up. So, you put them on the stairs and sit there for 2 hours because you went across the road without looking both ways. How does he know that? So it was just a wonderful time. Then we had to come back because this awful mother-in-law was dying in 1982. She should never have come back. We came back to the United States and I took up this counterintelligence, counter-deception business. But Washington, D.C. is an awful place to live. Unless you're a bachelor. Just don't try and raise a family there. Oh, it's hard.
So you were in the NSA in between Vietnam and going to Berlin?
After Berlin, but before... Between Berlin and Germany again. So a two-year tour there. It was a crippling place for my career, and I never recovered from that. It was it's a long story on how the Air Force changed its officer effectiveness rating system, and going to NSA precluded me from becoming a colonel. Yeah. So it happened to many guys, so nothing special to me. Chance. Make good plans. You got a plan, but the chance has factors in on that also.
Was it your choice to go to the NSA, or were you ordered there?
Well, I had to leave Germany and find another assignment, and so it was my choice. Why not? And then when I got there, and as I got there, the officer promotion system changed. Boy, it was awful. It was just awful. But that's another story. That's intricate in its own right.
Why was it the NSA so awful?
Well, because you weren't doing Air Force things, and they're trying to protect their... The Air Force was trying to protect its pilots, so they're having to downsize, and they're putting pilots out into holding patterns. NSA was one of the holding patterns for a bunch of Air Force pilots, and so they'd always give, and your NSA was only allotted a certain number of outstanding OER slots. And so those were given just automatically to your pilots. I wasn't a pilot. So that didn't get sorted out for a couple of years. And by that time I had these less than outstanding OERs in my system. And I didn't fully understand. It was only years later that I fully understood what the problem was. And by that time, it was too late to change it. And 1989 was the right time to retire, too. So it worked out for the best. We take a break. Let's see if that's...
What made you decide to go into military intelligence and continue to serve overseas outside of the U.S.?
Well, I love overseas. I'm a genetic linguist. Languages come easy to me. I love Germany, and I loved Europe, and I'm comfortable in both those places. I speak German and French fine. And I was a farm boy in northern Wisconsin, wondering whether I'd ever get out of Lincoln County. And when I came to University of Wisconsin, it was like, holy smokes, I'm where it's at. And then, of course, being there at it where I was at, and I just wanted to keep traveling. And genetic, I guess. I got two of my kids, two of my daughters, travel everywhere, you know. They're ready to go at a moment's notice. And the other three are just happy sitting in one place, intellectual or whatever pursuits. So I'm one of those who have itchy feet. And Germany, I really like Germany. I get along great with the Germans. It's whom I grew up with. And lifting a beer and eating a schnitzel is just as good as it gets. And the other thing, Germans like exercise, but they like exercising comfortably. So, you're going to take a walk in the mountains. Oh, I'm going to go walking in the mountains. Well, you should go at the start of the mountain trail. It's a nice gravel path, leveled. You walk up. You walk a good hearty 4 miles. And then there's a nice Gasthaus where you can sit down and have a coffee and a Kuchen or a beer. And then walk back down another 4 miles. And there's a Gasthaus at the end. Ha! That's a good day's exercise, don't you think? Then when you get to the end, of course, the tables are all full of other Germans and you're bunching, talking and talking politics. Oh, what a Saturday afternoon. And see, that's what it's becoming like around Madison here. But not so much the walking, but we're getting these network of bicycle trails. Same thing. So, as you know, you can go down to Paoli. A good, formidable 10-mile ride. And then there's a couple of great restaurants down there, nice beer halls. Or not beer halls. A lot of nice things happening here. A different way of exercising, though. This is a German state. That's great.
What does a signals officer do?
Signals intelligence officer. So in the old days, maybe still these days, you'd intercept enemy radio communications. And so that's, so in Germany, because of line of sight limitations, in the VHF and UHF spectrum, Berlin was a great place because it was right in the middle of the group of Soviet forces, Germany, and you could intercept their FM and UHF tactical communications very well. And you'd figure out how they were going to fight from that. It was pretty effective. And then you'd try and match that up in other places at NSA and DIA with all sorts of information. So you'd hear the radio communications and then mix them up with the human and the photo intelligence. But as a starter, that's what I was doing, was signals intelligence, intercepting enemy radio communications. Then there's a whole 6-credit course on how it's all put together. Sometimes it works for you, sometimes it don't. They're still doing it, in Iraq. They're figuring out how to intercept cell phone conversations. And then the enemy figures out how to code them up. And then we figure out how to break their code. And then they figure out how to code their coding and stuff like that. And I'm 20 years out of it. I don't know what's going on now. I don't know if you can... how secure your Gmail is. Apparently not.
Yeah, I'm sure they could break into anything. It's whether they have the right to, I suppose.
It's hard to tell, but that's a whole new world of encryption. I mean, they're all... just as an aside, you're hearing the stories. What was it? 3-4 days ago, we started on Gmail. My wife and I started getting offers or requirements from our bank to fill out our social security number and stuff. And apparently, they broke into. Oh, one of the major banking systems, computer systems, hacked it, and then downloaded all these reports, but could not get, somehow their security, our social security numbers weren't in there. So they're asking us for them. And right away you saw this bullshit, but then a couple hours later it was on the news that they'd hacked into Bank of America or something, banking system. So if some doofus, you know, with a can of Coke and a Twinkie in front of him can get in there, I would hope NSA could.
What stands out to you in your time in Berlin?
Oh, Jesus.
Too much?
Too much. But many things. But the one, I played rugby there for 4 years, and it was just miraculous. Two, the Berlin Opera and the Berlin Philharmonic. It cost us soldiers $1 to $5 for a ticket. I was absolutely in love with the prima ballerina of the Berlin Ballet, Eva of the Komova. She was just beautiful, and slim, a beautiful ballet dancer. And then the a famous soprano, Jessie Norman, at the Berlin Opera. And Jessie Norman was a black American female, and still singing, I guess. but she would often sing Aida, the role of Aida. Well, she's built like this chair. And she was a 16-year-old Egyptian girl, or Ethiopian slave. And Radames was a little dago. And he'd try and put his arm around her and protect his little Aida. I mean, their voices were gorgeous, just gorgeous. But you really couldn't watch the stage. And then at the Berlin Philharmonic, Herbert von Karajan was the maestro. And you could go see Herbert, and it would be divided up into three parts, two intermissions. You go, Jesus, I don't like what he's doing in the first part. I'll come there late, because it's only $4. I just want to hear him play the piano sonata, number 6, and then I'd leave. I mean, that was available to me, and I went a lot. And so the music scene was wonderful, and the bar scene was great. But there were these, because there are these small bars. In addition, so the music was wonderful. The sports complex, sports world, was great. Playing against the British, French, and German teams, rugby. I highly recommend it. What a good time it is. And then there were lots of just, the Germans like nice places. The Kneipe. Nice bars and nice restaurants. And not bars in our American sense, but just sort of more coffee house-ish, but with big cheese plates and big beers and lots of students around. And the fourth thing I did was I attended classes at the Berlin Free University, in Russian. German was not good enough at that time. And it used to be just so funny because the Berlin Free University was just a hothouse of leftist communist students, learning Russian, no less. And so they'd have strikes every so often, where they'd want to discuss, have political discussions in class. But the little German shits would transfer to German, and I'd say, no, no, you got to speak Russian because I don't speak German. And it was so interesting because German students' political discussions was they'd take a breath and then start speaking clearly an unmemorized 15-minute position. And I swear they wouldn't take a breath for 15 minutes. they're Germans. They're just, they hated you as a symbol of capitalist oppression. But get along just great with you and have a beer with you after class. And you'd date the leftists and you just wouldn't talk politics. There was always something else you could figure out to do. So it was just a wonderful place. I've gone back to Berlin a couple of times. It's not the same Berlin it used to be. And on top of that was a couple of our sites had these 500-600-foot tall radio towers where we hung the antennas on. So you could go up there and it was right on the wall. So you'd look over in East Germany. Every New Year's in Europe, Germany especially, lots of fireworks, lots of party, lots of light. So, man, you could just see where the wall was because it was dark black on the other side, on the East German side. Just fireworks and noise and cars and everything. It was just night and day at midnight. And that lets you know, again, what you were fighting for. There was the wall. There, first concrete wall. You'd go up above and see the three rows of barriers back 200, 300 meters. And the German soldiers guarding it. It was as sad as it got. And it was, at midnight, on New Year's, every year, difference, night, day, a lot. Berlin, I liked it a lot.
How much of your work as a signals intelligence officer was focused on the Soviet Union?
95% of it. We'd track the Germans and the Poles, but they're just, so say I had 80 men working for me. 70 were Russians, Russian linguists, 5 were German, 3 were Polish linguists, and then me and my NCOIC. It's all Russian. The Germans were more disciplined. Thunder Russians. They didn't have to yak so much. And they didn't. The Russians would come as student pilots. And they'd train them in Germany. Yak, 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 dog, 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 dog. Well, the German pilots had been 10 years of experience, 15 years of experience. They'd have been tough cookies to deal with. The Russians, they're either at your throat, at your feet, or at your throat. And that's what they used to say about the Germans, Russians. I love them all, love them all. I just don't like communists.
What was your time like working in the CIA?
That was very, very interesting. The CIA people are professional, hardworking, backstabbing sons of bitches like any bureaucracy. Because you want to get promoted and you want to make more money and you want to be promoted for pride reasons. So, the world's a bell curve and there's absolutely golden people and then there's snakes. In my Air Force, bell curve. So, but for the most part, at the working level, they're disciplined, hardworking, thoughtful people. And this is interesting. I don't, for you young people going into these worlds, because you know, if you go into government or politics, you have to be loyal to your organization to a certain extent. And then if you're not loyal, you're punished by not being promoted. But you walk a fine line. And God, I have no advice. You do the best you can until the organization is so clearly wrong, you resign. I don't know. So that was the first thing. Second thing, it was so intellectually compelling, this working for very, very bright people, doing a very, very hard task, and which I had subsequently learned was made much harder because the Soviets had broken all our fucking codes and would know what we were thinking and would be able to send false information that confirmed our false assumptions. And I think I wrote on one of my papers, I wrote about that, and I'm going to revisit that problem over the next several years. So we got snookered. We broke some of their deceptions. Must have really pissed them off when they read about us having broken their deceptions. But it was intellectually the most powerful time of my life, and it was a major cause of my exhaustion. It's called burnout, exhaustion, whatever. It's like, you know, you're trying to break a problem, and you just break your skull thinking about it. You never solve it completely, but you don't control yourself. You know, you gotta watch your health. So I would jog every day and watch my meals, and I slept okay. But so that allowed me to go 7 years rather than 4 years. I had nothing. When you burn out, it's an interesting phenomenon, and the exhaustion is utter. And it took me several years really to get back up to intellectual speed, 3-4 years. And luckily we were very wealthy, so I didn't have to find a job when I came back. But it was exciting, but also hard. And then I find this, as I read back, that's often a problem for Americans. I'd read the memoirs of officers who worked for General Marshall in World War II, and I'd say, just couldn't understand how tired we were when the war ended. And likewise, you found that with guys were dedicated to the Vietnam solution, how tired they were, maintaining a balance. But then that's your personal problem. I maintain a balance for 7 years. So jogging, weightlifting, and watching your diet, that worked. Working out. It's important. And a lot of guys are doing that now. Because when I, you know, before I got to the Pentagon in that area, Christ, they're pulling, they'd take colonels out of there every day, dead, you know, because they wouldn't watch their diet, heart attacks and stuff like that. Tension got to them, kabook, and sort of got to our generation. But that's, I don't know what to say to you young men and women who are going into this business now. It's going to grab you. How do you, but you can't do it all. And then how do you figure out a balance there? I guess the only thing I regret is I didn't study a lot harder when I was in the university. But what? Study what? You know, and I don't know how I would have prepared better for this work than what I did. study Russian verb cases better. Huh? About the only thing I can think of.
As Deputy Chief Air Force Intelligence Agency Counter-Deception Directorate in the CIA, what were your duties?
It was to manage the analysts, to it was personnel management, and it was to get the enlisted men and the young officers to do the work and put them in the right places, and then know what they're doing, protect them, get them their working aids and materials, and then advertise by going out and giving briefings and writing publications and whatever, their stuff. They're human beings. Some were lazy, some were ambitious, some were breaking down mentally. What's that point where you have to get rid of him? Is he just a simple alcoholic and has a hangover now? Or is his family life so disintegrating? And how much more time can I get out of him? Because I'm not going to get a goddamn replacement for him for a year. And besides, why would you ask an enlisted man to move to a cost of living hell, Washington, D.C.? We did anyway. Then this guy gets destroyed in an instant because he's driving and his mistake, his wife and child get killed. Or his wife gets killed, child severely injured. And watch him come apart. But it takes a year to, because you send him to the psychiatrist, take his clearance away, comes back, it's not working, send him again, and that takes up your time. The female lieutenant is slowly coming apart, slowly, 18 months before your eyes. When you finally realize it, you should have gotten rid of her a year ago. She's, you know, destroyed the morale of your unit, or really, and sucked up your time that you didn't have. So, managing people, tough stuff. At the same time, then, I was doing the work to upgrade their data automation capabilities to get them all, at that time they worked with pen and paper. You're trying to get them the equivalent of Microsoft Office, which didn't exist at that time, and access to 6 or 7 intelligence databases, which is Google now, and you're doing the contracting for that, and getting the contracting through people who didn't believe in that horseshit. So it was hard, because you knew the war was going to last. You're going to be fighting the Soviets for another 30 years, and you're trying to develop the capabilities to allow you to look through their deception plans so you can find their actual formations and kill them all. Was your goal.
Were the people under you doing work similar to what you did in Berlin as a signals intelligence officer?
No, they were taking stuff from Berlin, from the overhead imagery systems, and from other intercept sites, plus human and plus open source information, and telling the story about the Soviet deception program. Also the Iraqi deception program. Soviets trained the Iraqis to hide their weapons of mass destruction and put false information into our intelligence system. And so, during the first Gulf War, we found out that Saddam was only several months away from deploying a nuclear weapon. Emptied that. But between the two wars, he had to convince his neighbors that he had nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Not only convinced his neighbors, but who else? Using a deception, us, and all of Western intelligence. Now that was after I was out, but I could see him, the deception plan he's running here from Madison. Oh, you should, you know, what a wicked web we weave when first we practice deceive. You gotta be, now one of the bad things about running deceptions, several bad things. One, you don't know what's gonna happen. If you convince them, Saddam Hussein got hung because he convinced us that he had weapons of mass destruction. In the Soviet case, they lied so much that their own population no longer believed them. And they just stopped working for them. Stopped working. They went on strike. And the whole Soviet system, like air being let out of the system. You pretend to pay me, I'll pretend to work. Soviet workers, slang phrase.
What kind of worldview did working for the CIA give you?
I came with my worldview already.
It didn't change much then?
Didn't change much. CIA guys are 100% Americans. Bell curve. Liberals, conservatives, rock hard conservatives, flaming liberals. Down the center, they're Americans. Just like you and me, mm-hmm. and you, and it's a great, great job, CIA, for young people, particularly those who want to be linguists and like that sort of thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful place. Train you to be a linguist, the work they give you is very interesting. Yeah, Christ, when you start, you're treated like dregs, but not so much. It seems to be boring, but never is, because it's boring, boring, boring until the shit hits the fan. And, you know, the backwater of CIA and NSA was Iraq. You know, in my organization, we put maybe 0.04% of our time into that. Became very important one happy day. Became vitally important. And that's what sort of bites in the ass, and like that's a soldier's life. You know, you're just training, practicing marksmanship, nothing happening. Taking a tank apart, putting it back together again, taking it apart, putting it back together, and then all of a sudden war hits and people are shooting at you while you're taking the tank apart, putting it back together again. Becomes very serious all of a sudden. It's a real exciting life for these. It's a strange world, and it always is. If you leave this area and go out into that, it seems boring, and then becomes very, very interesting. But the intellectually, my time at CIA was compelling intellectual work. I wasn't well prepared, but none of us are. So.
Were there distinct differences in relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and differences in deception between the different Soviet leaders? You already covered this a little bit with the differences, but
yeah, but there was the Soviet leaders till the very end, till Gorbachev, were well schooled in the deceptive arts. Brezhnev was a commissar for the 40th Army. 40th Army was a deception army for the deception stuff. He is well versed in the deception arts. All of the Soviet leaders are, and they say all Russians are. I don't know about that. So they emphasized it. No, Gorbachev was came up, was another generation. And he was, I'm going to go back and look at that, but he, over the next couple of years, but he was more inclined, what's the word for it, using cybernetics to manage the perceptions of the people's, your perceptions, whose perceptions you're attempting to manage. Don't ask me any more about this. Come back in 3-4 years. Because I have those papers around here. And the paper, these papers were written in the 1984, 85, 86, 87. The Russians have always been stars in theoretical mathematics. We hired a whole shipload of them here at the University of Wisconsin after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mathematics departments in most of the major universities of the United States are populated with great Russians. But it, I didn't understand it at the time. Don't understand it now. Probably never will, but I'm going to look at it again. But it was a different way of doing deception. That's all I can say about it now. The Russians were the Brezhnev, Chernenko, Khrushchev. They had a tactical way of looking at it. Gorbachev, new Soviet man. That's all I can say.
What were some of the major events that occurred while you were in the CIA?
Should have thought of this. Well, the major effort during that time was Reagan became president in 80.
Mm-hmm.
I came to CIA in 82. He proposed Star Wars in 83. We did a lot of work with Star Wars. And Star Wars, one of the key things to make a deception work is it has to have a great deal of truth associated with it. So everybody in the United States knew that Star Wars wouldn't work. And the only question was whether Reagan or the nuclear, Edmund Teller, thought it would, believed it would work. Everybody in the Soviet Union knew it wouldn't work. And whether it was a deception or not,
they knew it would, or they knew it wouldn't?
They knew it would work. They had a high opinion of our technical prowess. But a man on the moon, running people around the states, were deploying those systems that were negating their main force divisions. The Israelis, our students in the Middle East, beat the Egyptians in 67, 73, and then the Baikal Valley affair in 78, where we defeated the Israelis, defeated the Soviet air defense system in Lebanon, using this, that, and the other thing. So they knew we were technologically astute. Most of the Russian hierarchy were peasant boys who grew up gangsters, knifing their way to the top. And technology was a mystery to the Soviet leadership. Gorbachev, too, was from Sverdlovsk. Not Sverdlovsk, but another small town. Worked his way up through the party chain of command. Responsible for agriculture. Smart guy. But it's all Greek to him, this technology. So they believed it. Now, I don't know if Gorbachev was running a deception against his own Communist Party, saying we need to end the arms race because we can't match it. But no, they knew we'd beat their ass technology-wise. Wozniak, Stephen Jobs, Bill Gates won the Cold War for America, indirectly. And Soviets were, just could not match them. Couldn't do it. They couldn't do the mainframe computer technology. They just couldn't implement it. They could do the theoretical stuff, wonderful. But they just couldn't implement it down at the lower levels. So, looked like we'd win. They bought it. Still don't know if it's a deception or not, because the program sort of died out after the Soviet Union collapsed. I'll look at that too. And that's one of the things I want to look at when I'm finished with these novels is, did Gorbachev really believe in Star Wars? Star Wars. Was it a deception or not? I want to go back at that. So it was that was, to me, the big issues. And that's what my world circled around. Did anything else happen in the 80s? I didn't notice. Yeah, we deployed the Pershing and cruise missiles to Europe. Yeah, a lot was happening there. But I was so involved in arms control negotiations and counter-deception that nothing else happened. Revisit that.
We've covered this a little bit, but what perspective on the Cold War did working for the CIA give you, as opposed to if you hadn't been in military intelligence?
It just gave me a perspective on how that our intelligence, we have too many, we're spending way too much money on intelligence. We have way too many people in intelligence. It's just fucked up. And I knew that even before George W. Bush expanded intelligence on the war on terror. The more people you have working for you, the more energy you devote into managing people rather than doing the intelligence. If I was a senator, I'd be cutting that intelligence budget out the wazoo. It's just way, way too many people. It might be one of the reasons we won the Cold War is because Soviets broke our code system in 67 with Walker Whitworth. Well, they expanded the KGB 100-fold to deal with the take. KGB became this fat, bloated, bureaucratic organization that couldn't do crap. Fixed those guys, didn't we? Yeah, they're good, and it just became enormous. And we're, the United States intelligence is in the same boat. Way too many people. Work on that.
We covered this quite a bit, but besides being just completely mentally and physically exhausted, why did you decide to retire in 1989?
Well, I was thrown out of the military. So I had, because of the OER system.
That was the advancement system?
That was the advancement system, the promotion system. So, and I just wanted to get the hell out of Washington, D.C., and I wanted to come back to Wisconsin where it was peaceful.
It was.
And then Madison was a compromise. I wanted to move back to the farm, and my wife at the time didn't like that at all. So Madison was the compromise.
What did you think when the Berlin Wall fell?
Awestruck. My mouth, my jaw dropped, hit the ground. Look at that. How'd that ever happen? I would have never expected it. Just amazed. And but it, you know, we knew when the communists stopped shooting their own people that it collapsed. And Gorbachev said he wouldn't shoot anybody anymore. So he collapsed. Who would have thought? Because he, you know, he did exercise force in the Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and in the Transcaucasus. And then after, came to Jesus or something, but he said he would not support East German use of force in controlling their borders. And East Germany went to West Germany via Czechoslovakia. So in that sense, I knew it happened. I just didn't believe that. I didn't. It was only later that I realized when that generation of Stalinists died, then the world would change. And that wasn't until after, well after that. Oh, so that's what happened.
This moves into my next question, which is, what did you think when Gorbachev announced the end of the Soviet Union?
Then the last two things. Interesting. And then by that time I was somewhat recovered and I wanted to get civilian jobs as a Sovietologist. And there was no more Soviet to be a Sovietologist about. So I had to figure out, I had to come to a different way of attacking the world. So I set up some businesses with some buddies to go to the Soviet Union to see if there's some way we could trade U.S. agricultural technology into the former Soviet Union. But it was more of a wreck than I even realized. I'd made several trips to Soviet Union, or former Soviet Union, in the 2002-2003, and it was really a sad situation, and it became increasingly criminal as we got on. There was just no way I could in good faith encourage anybody to invest in anything where you couldn't get your money out right away. So if you had to expose your assets for more than 3 months, not a good deal. So and you know, a lot of Americans tried it and got shredded. My favorite was Ben and Jerry's, the ice cream people. They wanted to set up a program or a outlet in that socialist country. So they're from New Hampshire or something. And several years later, the goodness of their heart, they gave it to the Russian people. Bullshit! It was taken away from you, you assholes. And Soviet Russia now is just such a gangster nation. The youth are leaving by the tens of thousands. Smart kid, and we went there 2 years ago to teach English, and the students are bright kids like you are. Get the hell out of here. Gorbachev is a KGB gangster, or Putin is a KGB gangster, and the Duma passes laws so they can confiscate people's businesses. The tax rate is 176%, so in Moscow at least. So anybody, no businessman, is anything but a criminal. And you keep going until they want your business, and then you're a tax cheat. So it's, you know, Shell Petroleum bailed out of the Soviet Union because they took their portion of their investment. And British Petroleum is trying to go back in there since, you know, they got skinned in the Gulf of Mexico. The United States has its criminal enterprises also are illegal. You know, what the fines we imposed on British Petroleum weren't legal. They just had to pay them. So, but Russia is pretty much a gangster enterprise now. Now, it was a gangster enterprise from 1917 also. You know, it's just a criminal organization. Just because we wouldn't call it that is another question. But KGB or... And the party was above the law. So, and that continues to this day. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you have any thoughts for the future? In what you plan to do, in how you think the world's going to be, in any sense?
From my story here, you must realize that I have no idea how it's going to turn out. My objective is to go back over the past, see if I can make sense of my role in it. And that's what I want to do, and I can do it. And I'll be heartily disappointed if I can't. But I've been disappointed before. So and we're done. Turn it off. You can turn it off.
I just have one last question.
Oh, go ahead.
Do you have any regrets?
Not studying harder as a student. Not having a world view when I left college.
Certainly gained it after it. Worse,
gained it after it. But, and I don't know, there's an essay by, it's called The Hedgehog and the Fox. Now remember, Isaiah Berlin. I really recommend you read that. But his concept is that there's two ways historians or people look at the world. There's the hedgehog, and he's discussing Tolstoy at this time. The hedgehog has one view of what the world is about, and he will keep that view forever. Vladimir Lenin, hedgehog. Nikita Khrushchev, hedgehog changing. Or the fox. The fox sees many variations on how the world can organize itself. And I'm clearly a fox. I mean, I can see everybody's point of view. I can even see the fucking communists' point of view. And I can sympathize with their point of view. But that's a hard position for a man of action, soldier, to cope with, to travel through a world beset with deceptions, counter-deceptions, liars, truth here, but a mutable truth. It makes it hard. And Lenin sure made a wreck of the world, so did Stalin. And so those states organized around the immutable truth aren't necessarily more effective than those who see the world and from many different perspectives. So, regrets? No regrets whatsoever. I wish I would have understood women better, understood that we are human beings facing one another rather than men and women. Other than that, I've got yeah, didn't do that badly. So, no regrets whatsoever. Maybe should have been an Army officer rather than an Air Force officer. The Army changed over time, so no, I don't regret that either. So, you're a political science major?
Mm-hmm. And just let me say thank you for allowing me to do this interview.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome very much. It's my pleasure. Particularly my pleasure, these great questions you put together. I'm telling you, I'm going to be using them over the next several years.
You're very welcome to.
Thank you. I got your permission.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, turn it off. Nugget, my question to you is, you're a political scientist.